It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, beautiful listeners. It's your host, Tembi Lopp. Welcome to Lifted, a podcast that pulls back the curtain on creativity, resilience, and the extraordinary moments when everything changes. My guest is one of the reasons why I wanted to do this particular season of Lifted, wherein I pull at the thread of the theme of food and look at all of its complexities and how it touches every corner of our lives. My guest is Dawn Davis, a publishing powerhouse. She is a graduate of Stanford University, and she began her career in investment banking before a fateful moment on an airplane changed all of that. She published her first book, If You Can Stand the Heat, Tales of Chefs and Restaurateurs, in 1991. And it featured a then relatively unknown chef by the name of Anthony Bourdain, as well as the iconic Edna Lewis. She then went on to publish for Penguin Random House and later HarperCollins, where she was vice president and editorial director of Amistad, the company's imprint devoted to work from and about the African diaspora. There, she published Edward P. Jones's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Known World. She went on to found 37 Inc. at Simon Schuster, where she published books by Issa Rae, as well as Never Caught by Erica Dunbar, which was nominated for a National Book Award. And in 2020, Dawn became the editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine. And in so doing, she became the first Black editor-in-chief of that publication. And of the transition, she said, I'm going to use my skills, everything I've learned in terms of storytelling, to show people how food is really connected to family, history, equity, access, farming, and community. And she does all that in our conversation today. We talk about serendipity and adventure as a guiding tool, about advice that she got from Bourdain, as well as insight she brings to day one of a new professional adventure. Dawn can definitely stand the heat. And this conversation will inspire foodies and writers and home cooks, but it will also remind you of the power of kindness just because. Hello, Dawn, and welcome to the Lifted podcast.
Hi, Tembi. So nice to be here.
I am so excited to have you here. The fact that we've been orbiting each other, we've met in person, but this conversation is something I have so been looking forward to. I will say for listeners that you published Atticus' first book,
and her second book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you are a name that I have known since, I want to say, like, I don't know, 2008, 2009, somewhere in there, 10, somewhere in there. I can't even recall now.
It's been a long time, and I've heard your name as well. And Attica would say, you think I'm talented, you've got to meet my sister. So I've heard about you for so long. And then, of course, when I was here at Simon, my colleagues were so excited about From Scratch, and the excitement and watching the enthusiasm build was really fun for me to witness. So yes, it's nice to finally be in touch directly.
I love it. So Dawn, you were born in Los Angeles, correct?
I was, exactly.
And I heard that you went to Immaculate Heart.
I did. I went to Immaculate Heart.
My daughter almost went there.
Why didn't you send her there?
Well, she ended up wanting to go to a co-ed school, but what's interesting is that she's now at an all-women's college. So it just, I guess she wasn't ready at high school. She's there for college.
Oh, how fascinating. I loved Immaculate Heart, all-girl Catholic school, super diverse, both socioeconomically, racially. I loved it. It was a great experience.
What part of LA did you guys live in?
So I grew up in a part of LA that really had no name, although it's mid-city and you know, south of Farmers Market, south of Hollywood, north of Venice Beach, just to the east of Beverly Hills. It was a fabulous place to grow up because you could get everywhere without getting on the highway. And you could just, it was just normal, if you know what I mean.
Who cooked in your home?
So my mother and my aunt, my mom would do, so I don't know, we've never talked about this, but my mother's mother was Italian from the south of Italy.
This is a question I had a few questions out. Please tell me everything, because I know that there's sort of this like Black Italian intersection interest that you have, and I never understood why. So tell me the story.
Yeah, you know, my grandmother immigrated from southern Italy, as so many Italians did, due to the poverty and just lack of opportunity. And I knew her. She lived in Pennsylvania, where she married an African-American man, my grandfather. They had 7 kids together. And this was before, you know, interracial marriage was even legal in most states. And they had 7 extraordinary children. And that has always prompted my interest and informed my interest in Italy. So in college, I studied Italian. I can't really speak it now, but that interest in the culture has, you know, been something that I've always, always had. So our meals at home were like very American, you know, steak and lamb chops, pasta, although we only called it spaghetti and lasagna. And also some Southern traditions, you know, like macaroni and cheese and greens and things of that nature. So it was this lovely, lovely combination of all the things that just I think of as like deeply American food. And then my aunt was the fantastic cook. She would make tacos and homemade salsa, and she would make gumbo, and, you know, really taking advantage of all the different communities that lived in Southern California. So my aunt did a lot of the cooking, particularly around the holidays. And every week I would have at least 2 meals at my aunt's house, if not 3. So I ate well. I won't say it was like a gourmet upbringing, but I ate well.
You ate well. And with a great deal of variety, which, you know, I think will, as this conversation unfolds, listeners will understand exactly why the point of view you have on not only publishing and your impact is it's informed by this diversity. Did they immigrate here from another part of America, like the South, where they are part of the Great Migration?
Well, so my mom and my aunt came from Pennsylvania. So the oldest sister actually joined the military, which is really unusual for an African-American woman at the time. And all of her siblings followed her out to California. And so really Western Pennsylvania, near a town called Indiana, Pennsylvania, right? And not a lot of people know there's a university there. And I believe, oh my goodness, I have to, the actor, Jimmy Stewart, is from Indiana, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Americana.
And then, of course, you know, most African Americans in this country of a particular age have roots in the South. So some Alabama roots as well. But really, I was closest to my mother's family. And just we would be in California, we would go on vacations to Pennsylvania. So when my kids would complain about vacations, I'd be like, you know, my first 15 vacations were to a town near Pittsburgh, you know, so stop complaining.
Was publishing or food or being in the publishing industry or a chef, was any of that on your radar as a child?
Not at all. And one of the things that I like to encourage young people to do is to acknowledge serendipity. You know, I sat next to a publisher on a plane and I thought, you get paid to read? I am an only child. All I do is read. And that, you know, one thing led to another. I was aware then that there was this position called publisher and that there was this industry called publishing. You know, there's not a lot of publishing in California, so it wasn't something I had been exposed to. Hollywood, yes, people's parents worked in Hollywood in some capacity. The defense industry when I was growing up, that was a big part of the LA economy, but not publishing. So that is what led me into book publishing. And food, you know, I would get Food and Wine or Bon Appetit, and I'd read the letter from the editor. And I just thought, what an extraordinary, fun dream job, never knowing that that would be, you know, in my future one day, but acknowledging that that would be a particularly exciting area in which to work.
So you, I read you were in investment banking, correct? And that's when you made the pivot. Was it direct investment banking? So Stanford banking, publishing?
It was Stanford banking because it was the only way I knew how to get to New York. They were the kinds of companies that were recruiting and bringing people to live in New York. So it was like a means to an end. I knew that early on, but it was fabulous. It was a great experience. I don't regret it. And then it was a Rotary scholarship that someone at the bank said, I think you should apply for a Rotary scholarship. And I went to Nigeria in 1990, before the internet, which was a really, really foundational experience for me in some ways, in many ways.
How? Can you tell us a little bit how and why it was foundational?
You know, so my mom actually said something to me. It was hard. That's why it was hard. I had lived a pretty safe life until then. I had, you know, a loving family. I went to Stanford. I met all these amazing people. I then went to New York City and started in an analyst class. There are 50 people also my age who are all over America. We're working together. It was really fun. I was really lucky. And then I go to Africa. I literally don't know a soul. I don't have, you know, a sponsor or a host family. I get on a plane. The program was postponed because of civil unrest. And so I was supposed to start in September. Civil unrest, I didn't start until January. And I literally, I was temping. All of my friends were going on to Yale Law School and Harvard Business School. And here I am temping, waiting for this opportunity to come back. And I was starting to doubt myself and feel like, you know, you were on this upward trajectory, Stanford and then Wall Street. And now you're literally temping at ABC, the network. And I got there, you know, this opportunity opened up and minute they said, yes, okay, you can come now. I got on a plane. And it was funny, actually, there was a changeover in London and University of Pennsylvania, I believe, was sending their first class also to Nigeria. And the administrator looked at me and he said, you don't have any sponsor. You don't have any paperwork. You don't have a dorm for when you land. And he's like, just, I don't know how this is going to work, but you are an adopted University of Pennsylvania student right now. Serendipity, taking chances. If my child were to call me and tell me they did that, of course I would string them up. But at the time, it was an amazing experience. So from there, I met a publisher on the plane. I don't know if it was there or back. I believe it was there. But when I got back, the first thing I did was try to find a job in publishing.
This is the most incredible story I think I've heard, like, in months.
I know, it's great. It is a crazy.
It's crazy, but so beautiful. And you talk about talk about serendipity. And in fact, throughout the season, talking to women in and around the food space and culinary arts, there's so many stories like this. It's like some serendipitous moment, some aha. So fascinating. Absolutely. So you are back at stateside. You immediately make a beeline for the publishing industry, right?
I do. And I get introduced to an amazing man named Andre Schifrin, who had been the publisher of Pantheon, one of the august houses, part of Random House, part of the Knopf Group at the time. But he was kicked out of the Random House and was starting a new press called The New Press. And the idea was to be kind of like the NPR of publishing, to publish for the public good. They would eventually go on to publish The New Jim Crow, but they were doing those kinds of books way back in 1990. And that was the one that really broke out. But even before then, they were doing tons of books. They published, I just saw someone reading it on the subway today. Oh gosh, it's going to come to me. But anyway, they were publishing progressive books way back when.
And so, is that where you first published your book, If You Can Stand the Heat? Or was that idea for that book germinating while you were working there?
So I'll tell you how that book came about. I was happily publishing books. I did one book, Recipe of Memory, which was nominated for, you know, the James Beard Award and the IACP Award. But I had two great friends. They were a married couple. They were French. We loved to eat. Everyone in my community loved to eat. You know, it's like work hard, work late, but then reward yourself with a delicious dinner. You know, you're young, you could do that. And they said, you know, and they were getting PhDs in economics. And, you know, they're now world economists. So like one works for the Africa World Bank, one's a dean at a business school. But at the time, we were like, we should open a restaurant. We should open a restaurant. We would always throw dinner parties and we'd love to cook for friends and for each other. And I said, you know, the rational one of the group, I bet it's much harder when it looks, this was the dawn of the Food Network. And suddenly like chefs were in our home via the TV every day. And we were exposed to, you know, culinary techniques and culinary personalities. And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I think they make it look so much easier than it is. We should do some homework. And that's how my book, How to Stand, If You Can Stand the Heat, that's how my book, If You Can Stand the Heat, came to fruition. I decided to interview chefs from around the country.
That book includes, among others, Bourdain.
Yes.
Edna Lewis.
Yes.
I need you to tell me an Edna Lewis takeaway. What was the experience like interviewing her, meeting her? What was that? What did she teach you?
It was humbling. You know, she has so much humility and so much grace. She recounted stories about, you know, her origin story, which was really interesting. And it was just honestly being in the presence of a pioneer, just could be so humbling. I don't know another word for it. She painted a picture of New York at a time from her perspective and her lens that I had not heard those kinds of stories before. Being an entrepreneur, being a visionary, it was all so, so, so interesting. And also I got to meet Scott Peacock, who at the time was, of course, they were together. So I got to hear his stories, and he had an interesting story too, which was he was on his way to Italy, had loved Italian food. He was determined to go over there and to, you know, learn as much as he could. And Edna was like, value what's in your own backyard, value your own traditions. And so it was Edna who taught him to, you know, prioritize his own traditions. And he tells that story and how you can stand the heat. So it was great seeing their friendship. It was great, you know, hearing about running a cafe, running a restaurant, her own journey. It was humbling. And then the Bourdain is really fun. So there is a friend who is like, you know, produces some movies, writes some books, does a little of this, does a little of that. He's super great. And he said, look, if you're going to write about chefs, there is one person you have to meet. It's this guy named Anthony Bourdain. Bourdain wasn't famous in that kind of broad sense at that point. He had written mystery books. And so a few readers knew him. Some people in the culinary world knew him. And I, you know, said, can I interview you? And he said, yes, but you can't just write about it. You have to actually do it. So I worked with him on Fridays. I would work at my vintage books at the time. And I would finish at like 5:00. And then I would head over to his restaurant. At the time he was, I think, heading Sullivan. The Ed Sullivan Show had created like a restaurant, the studio. And I would go in and work with him for like, you know, one night a week. It was so much fun. And he talked exactly the way he talks in Kitchen Confidential. Like who I met is exactly who presented on in his book. So that was really thrilling.
Dawn, your life is on another level. Like, on another level. Like I don't know how many of us are, you know, sort of like having our 9 to 5. And then at the end of that, we go work with the likes of a Bourdain, you know, from 5 on in the evening.
I look back and I just think like, how did that happen again? You know, but he was so great. He was so fun and gracious. And then, you know, watching his whole world, you know, enlarge and, you know, he loved books. So getting to watch him become a New York Times bestseller and fulfill his dreams, that was really exciting too.
There is what I'm getting from you is a sense that one, you are up for adventure. You are not someone who is not up for adventure.
Yeah.
And there doesn't have to be a roadmap. You're okay without a roadmap. I mean, that's what I mean, because I'm sorry, who does, you went to Nigeria when there was unrest and there was no program, and yet you're there. Anthony Bourdain says, let's have dinner, or let's come cook with me. And you're like, sure, why not? I mean, this speaks to a kind of spirit, whether you see it or not. Those of us, I think, listening and me talking to you now, it's pretty clear. Is that something that you could sort of say, who else in your life had that? Were there people who modeled that energy, or were you just like, I am hungry for this thing called life and I'm going for it?
You know, it's so funny that you should say that. I feel like this is now a therapy session. Because I don't know that I saw that about myself until when I took the Bon Appetit job and I reconnected with my acupuncturist, who I hadn't seen in, you know, like a decade. And she said, oh, you're an adrenaline junkie. And I don't know that I would characterize myself like that, but I do think, I don't set out seeking a new adventure, but I do think the way you put it, yes, I'm not afraid of adventures. I think after I had some success in publishing, in book publishing, the Bourdain thing was just following my instincts. We say we want to open a restaurant. We know nothing about this. I go around the country and interview these amazing chefs. One of them says, you have to come cook too. You know, that was really, really fun. I think the Nigeria and even going to Bon Appetit were just a whole level of risk-taking that wouldn't describe myself as a risk-taker per se, but it was one of those things that if you feel safe enough to do it, then you can do it, you know? And one of the things I want to give credit to my husband, who has said, if this doesn't work out, our children won't starve. And so knowing that I could take some risk, and there's, you know, no one wants a public failure, but just knowing that I'm going to take this risk, and what's the worst that can happen? It doesn't work out, and being okay with that. But that implies that you have somebody in your corner, that you have some financial stability, that you know that you will be more unhappy if you don't do it than happy if you just kind of keep doing the same old same thing. So I think it's a combination of just not being afraid rather than like always seeking risk, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And also, I think what I sense on the outside, you know, knowing your work in the world, is that you also are bringing to this new experience a very specific point of view and perhaps an overarching goal that you'd like to offer this new experience in a way that maybe no one else could. And that's just me on the outside, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I wonder if, you know, to sort of say, yes, Bon Appetit, I'm saying yes to this experience. Why me? Why now? And what do I have to offer? Like, what is that? Is that what gets you up in the morning? Is like, oh, I can bring this that maybe people aren't thinking about.
Yeah, there are times when I absolutely think, what can I bring? And also just being really honest about what I can bring and what I can't bring, and making sure the people that I am working with are fully aware of that and not fronting and trying to be something I'm not. But, you know, saying I can absolutely bring, you know, in my sense, it was some editorial savviness, some diversity of authors, some way of thinking about food in a particular, hopefully more expansive kind of way. So actually, you know, being honest with yourself, being honest with your partners, and, you know, working with partners who are also open to taking some risk on people who are a little outside the box as well. You know, and also just to go back to your initial question, and I'm actually thinking about this as I say it out loud, that, you know, my husband gave me that, you know, go ahead, our children won't starve. But also my mother in Nigeria said, you know, you don't have to finish it. If you want to come home early, that's okay. It won't mean that you're a failure. And that also just helped me put this experience one day at a time, that, you know, you're winning just for taking the risk, and failure isn't black and white.
There are so many lessons in what you just said, which also transfer to the kitchen, which is like that idea of, let me try something. I'm going to be better for the trying than, you know, if I didn't try. It's not about getting the recipe perfect the first time, perhaps, or, you know, it's this sort of, I always use the term journeyman, and that's probably because of my background as an actor, but sort of being a journeyman with all of the things that we're doing in life, right? And it's absolutely. And it's just a beautiful way to move through things. And I think it keeps us open to synchronicities and to, you know, the things that, because we're not boxed in in the same way. Would you say
100%,
that?
100%. I love the term boxed in. That's exactly right. When I published Steve Harvey, and when I left, you know, he had runaway success and it was turned into a movie and the whole nine. And then when I left, I thought his team would be upset. And they said, no, we're proud of you. So many people stay in a box and we're proud that you're kind of breaking out and trying new things. So, yeah.
Do you feel that, you have aha moments in the kitchen personally when you cook? Like, or is that a time that is either meditative or it's sort of, is your mom, do you use it the way runners use running to sort of ideate and think about what's next? Is the kitchen a space like that for you, or is it a zone out space?
You know what it is for me? It is, it's meditative. It's a place of relaxing. It's a place where I can't think about my to-do list because it's one thing at a time. And I love the choreography of it all. Yeah, I just cooked for 9 people last night. And I love that, you know, I've got 3 hours. It's funny, I went out to lunch with this amazing woman who's actually a scholar of Italian food. And she's, do you know her?
No, yeah. I need her name, but keep going.
You need her name. And I said, oh, you know, we had lunch at 12. And I said, oh, I've got like 8 people coming over later. And she just looked at me and she said, I would be freaking out. I would have started cooking 2 days ago. And I mean, I literally started at like, you know, I was at the butcher at, I don't know, 3. But I love the, I love transforming the chaos into order. I love the choreography of it all. You know, Bourdain is the one who explained to me, like being in the back of the kitchen, it's almost balletic and that you have to get, you know, you start the music here and the tempo here in order for it to look like this on stage. And I love, that's what I love about cooking.
Makes you a damn good editor, because here's the thing, like writers are coming to you with like, it's not quite the chaos of all the words, but it's all the words and all the ideas, right? And what you do is make order of that and make the ballet that the reader is going to enjoy page to page. So I told, that makes sense to me that that is, would be your approach in the kitchen.
Oh my God. I feel like another therapy session. Thank you. Yes, I see the parallels now. That's so funny. Yes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So you have 9 people coming over for dinner. You are not in panic mode. You're in like, let's see what happens. This is going to come together beautifully. And so, you know, I, in this, in the course of this season of the podcast, I talk with, Chef Jenny Dorsey, who talked about how she, when she brings people to the table, she tries to bring intimacy to that experience. And I asked her to sort of unpack what does it mean to be intimate? And sometimes that was bringing something cultural to the table. She's Chinese American, that might challenge the diner, right? Like, what is that? Ooh, you know, or like they lean in, like she is challenged. She's bringing, so she's being intimate and vulnerable.
Love it.
But using it as a place to sort of begin a conversation. When you cook, what did you cook for the 9 people, by the way? And
I cooked a Vietnamese gazpacho, so yummy, from the pages of Bon Appetit. I cooked also from Bon Appetit a spatchcocked, and that's a fun word, a spatchcocked chicken with 5 spice and salt and a little brown sugar. So easy, but so delicious. And it makes the house smell so fantastic. And Andy Barragani, from his cookbook, The Cook You Want to Be, does these amazing potatoes with some preserved lemon. So easy. And then I did a corn salad also from Andy's book. And I had, or a kind of corn with some coconut cream. It was really yummy. And then I had a friend who was coming and I said, can you make this? I just had this idea of what to do with nectarines, which are really yummy right now. And we did a fattoush or bread salad with nectarines and tomatoes and fennel. And it was so yummy. It was good. It was really good.
I'm salivating just listening to you.
It was really good. But you know what was even better? The company. It was amazing. So 2 of my favorite booksellers happened to be in town. City Lights, I got to give them a shout out, in San Francisco Bay Area, one of the most famous stores in the country. And then Elliott Bay in Seattle. These independents have really kept writers such as yourself going, and novelists and debut authors, and they happened to be in town. And so I had them over with some colleagues. And what was important, the food was delicious, but honestly, I feel like the act of cooking for others, there's just love even before they taste it. Like the intimacy of opening your home, the intimacy of saying, yes, I spent time with this. I took time out of my Sunday to do this for you. That's like saying, I adore you. I cherish you. And so all of it, it was great just because of the act and the company. Great, great people.
I read recently, someone said that time is really the only currency we have. And that idea of when you talk about like the time I put into that, that's my love currency. That's the one thing I can choose and how I want to wield in this world. And so cooking in that way is very much an intimate act of love, because you're wielding really all the currency we have is right now. It's this moment.
100%. Exactly. We had a, when my son was in elementary school, there was a family that had a restaurant, and I would invite, you know, the families over, a couple of families from the class. And I said, aren't you stressed to cook for Victor, who has this great restaurant, Da Umberto, in Chelsea? And I was like, no one probably cooks for Victor. You know what I mean? Like, Victor's going to be happy no matter what. He's not the one cooking. He's not supervising. So it'll be fine. And it was indeed.
Okay. I want to pivot a little bit and talk about a column that you helped to shepherd at Bon Appetit, The Receipt. And for listeners who aren't familiar with this, it highlights sort of everyday people around America and their spending over the course of a week related to food. And yeah, for me, I remember the first time I saw this, my eyes like popped out of my head. I was like, what is actually happening? As riveted as if I were reading,
yes,
and maybe this is more revelatory of me, but I was reading it as though I were reading like the way some people would read, what was the sort of tabloid paper it was salacious. Yeah, the Inquirer or something. I was just like, how are people doing this? Like, what? How did they do it? And so it's basically looking at the intersection of food and money. But why did you feel like that this particular column, The Receipt, was important to document in America right now? And like,
well, I want to give a shout out to my team. They came up with that. They came to me and said, we want to do this. So it was a column that was digital only. And it was really fun, but it was kind of a no-brainer because, first of all, people are obsessed with how other people spend their money. You know, they're obsessed with, you know, how much they spend on their clothes or what kind of car they buy and the choices that they make. So it was kind of a no-brainer. And then I think you can just tell so much about, you know, a person if they, you know, make 3X and only go out to dinner, or only make X but buy only organic, you know, high-end food. So I just feel like you can learn so much about a particular person. We have one that we also started called The Fridge, which we do in print, and which Bon Appetit does in print. I have to use the right pronoun now that I'm no longer there. But like, show me what's in your fridge. You know, isn't that fascinating? Don't you want to look at people's spices? Don't you want to look at their flowers? You know, how many flowers do they? It's all fascinating.
Well, with my daughter, we looked at the receipt one day, and it was like, for her, she was like, wait, what is happening? You know, for her, you know, she's beginning to sort of, she's an emerging adult, just left home. And so she's thinking like, oh, food costs. And I was like, yeah, now go to the grocery store and buy our groceries for the week. You know, so it's also just, it is interesting in that way, but it's also, we use it as a teaching tool.
Oh,
and a way to have conversation.
Well,
food
is very expensive right now. So
it's crazy. So I have to ask you the question. I know you get asked a lot, but I wonder if it changes, which is I know you just had a dream dinner party in a way. So actually I'm gonna rephrase this question then. Let me ask it this way. As we're recording this, it's fall 2023. If you were to write or do the updated version of If You Can Stand the Heat,
ooh,
who would you want to include in that book today, and why?
That is a very good question. So that book was chefs. almost exclusively chefs. And then I had a couple of chefs who did other things, like became a caterer. So just for the audience to know. So what chefs would I want to interview? Would I want to include today? You know, one of the things I hope to accomplish with that book was that it was a career that was starting to be romanticized, given its due respect, peeling back the layers a little bit so that you could see what it was. And I think if I were to, so that was the point of the book. It wasn't to get the most famous chefs per se. I also wanted a diverse group of chefs. So I wanted women. One of the things they talked about is how hard it is to be a woman in that industry, because, you know, you're really working during bedtime and bath time if you have a young family, and you're working during holidays. And so I think if I were to do the book again, I would want to keep the same ethos, but I might want to maybe do a version that was all women. I think there's some fantastic women running some amazing restaurants. I know them mostly here in New York, but I might want to put the focus on them and talk about like how they do it. Or also some chefs that are husband-wife teams and think about how, you know, to run a business together. I'd want to talk about some of the people we profiled in Bon Appetit that run equitable kitchens, that run compassionate kitchens, and talk about, you know, what is a restaurant of the future going to look like in terms of who's cooking and how you compensate your employees. So I want to focus on that. Some chefs I'm really excited about. I love Kamari Mack, who's a pastry chef at the Musket Room. Love it. Who else do I love? I love Don Angie. I don't know if you've ever met those chefs, Scott and Angie. Angie's smile is megawatt. I'd want to kind of get in their head a little bit more. I love not a female, but love what they're doing at Resdora and the Flatiron. Northern Italian food, so yummy. We'd want to focus on that. Jess at King, she's very funny, British, kind of really developing interesting restaurants and spaces and doing great things with food. So I think I'd probably, but I'd want it to be geographically diverse, right? Because it's also so tough. And one of the things I did with If You Can Stand the Heat is I made sure it wasn't all New York, because running a restaurant in New York, say, versus California versus Oklahoma, where you might be dealing with a clientele that wants a certain kind of food and you have to expand, all different. So I think about those things.
I will tell you right now, I am here for that book. Should you ever decide that that is an endeavor you choose to take on, that sounds wonderful and amazing in every sense.
Well, we should also acknowledge that your recipe, so you contributed, I had a column at Bon Appetit called All on the Table. And the idea was emotional moments that take place at the proverbial dinner table and how food often plays that pivotal role in our memory. You remember where you were, what you were eating, you know, how you felt, what you were drinking, who served what, you know. And you wrote a beautiful story about coming to terms with meeting again, bonding with your mother-in-law. It was so beautiful. It was one of our most popular columns.
Thank you.
And
thank
the
you.
Recipe well, thank for Cucidati.
Did I say that? Yeah, Cucidati. Yeah.
Delicious.
Oh my gosh, Dawn, thank you so much. When the invitation came to do that, I was terrified and exhilarated. It's sort of like that moment you talk about where you're like, I would feel worse for not trying this, because the upside of doing it is who knows, you know, like it felt right. I wanted to work with you. I wanted to be a part of a Buena. That had been a dream for me that, you know, was sort of like, I hadn't even fully acknowledged for myself. So it was a yes immediately. And then I was like, oh gosh, now what am I going to do?
Now you've got to come up with a recipe and a story.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And my colleague Hillary does such a great
she's wonderful.
Job. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. She's wonderful.
Hillary Cadigan, great job.
When you're making that moment of a pivot from one position to the next, and it's your day one, like it's day one at Bon Appetit, or it's day one at 37 Inc., or day one, what do you bring to that first Monday morning meeting? Like, what are you, I mean, sort of internally, what are you hoping to achieve? Is it that being really honest with your colleagues and saying, this is what I want? Is it about the agenda? How do you prep for your day one? I think is the question, because so many of our listeners start these new endeavors. They're like, oh my, they're shaking in their boots. And they're looking to people like you who do it seemingly to us effortlessly.
That's such a great question. I mean, so I think it depends on what stage you are at in your career. So if you're at early stage, you bring just a warmth, a willingness to listen, a willingness to be helpful and to be expansive. So, you know, I know the position is technically this, but hey, I'd love to, you know, help out, or let me read that for you. There's a collegiality in book publishing that I've always tried to adhere to. What I found at Bon Appetit at a kind of a later stage in my career is that often before your first day, people have impressions of you based on what they've heard. And I think it's important to be the same person in the room that matches the reputation that you have. So at my goodbye toast, one of my colleagues said, I'd heard so much about you before you even walked in the room. And I had heard from so many people who knew you in some capacity that you were this kind of person. And the person that she met professionally was the person she'd heard about, right? And so just to be consistent is important. But at early stages, friendly, open, available, warm.
Who has lifted you at a pivotal moment in your career, and who have you lifted lately?
I love that question. So I got years ago when I worked at the New Press, my first job, my early days, and I know many of my big successes in terms of books were ahead of me. I probably had at that point worked on a couple of like important books. But I got a bouquet of flowers from a Black woman literary agent, Faith Child, for no reason. And it was literally just because of who you are in the world. And it is one of those gestures that I want to pay forward, because when you don't expect something and there's not like, you know, it's one thing to get flowers if you get someone's author on the bestseller list. That's also a beautiful gesture, but just for no reason, I mean, that was just amazing. And today, as you asked this question, I got an email from a young book publicist named Yona Desom, and I've known Yona, which is, you know, for a long time. She worked with me at Amistad. She worked with me here at Simon & Schuster. And I ran into an author over the summer, and he's like, I'm looking for an independent publicist. And I gave him her name, Otis Moss, who is amazing, runs Trinity Church in Chicago. And she sent me a note today saying, thanks, sis. It's going to be amazing. We're going to work together. And it's one of those things, like I hadn't even remembered. I was like, who are you going to work with? And then she reminded me. And so that's nice. And I will say, as a book publisher, I will run into people who will say, this happened last summer. Someone said, you won't remember me, and there's no reason you should. But years ago, I was a reporter at the Village Voice, and you reached out to me and said, I think you might have a book in you, and X and Y and X and Y. And even though it took me 20 years before I ever had a book, knowing that someone believed in me, knowing that you thought it might be possible, just really buoyed me on over the years. So I feel like, you know, little seeds along the way, you never know where they're going to land.
Well, Dawn, you were one of those little seeds for me. It was a big seed, because when I knew that, you know, From Scratch, that you wanted to even talk to me about From Scratch, I was like, oh my God, then... that to me was a win. Do you understand? I don't know that you understand what a big, it was such a win, because I was unpublished, a new writer, and I was going to have the opportunity to talk to Dawn Davis about this idea of a book.
That's like, so fascinating.
It was
because for me, you were like, Timby, even more talented than me. You got to meet her. She's amazing. Yeah. And
so there you go.
I was intimidated. I was like, oh
my gosh, no. Yeah. Well, that just goes to show, listeners out there, we're all bringing to the table, to your point, the sort of perceived, perceptions about the other person. And of course, I had heard absolutely wonderful things about you. So I felt, if I land with Dawn, if that works out, that would be wonderful and safe. But the main thing is that I get a chance to talk to her about this idea. And you were game.
A beautiful idea and a beautiful book. And, you know, I hope people understand how hard it is to write a memoir, how tough it is to sell a memoir to the publisher first and foremost, and then to the public even more so. And so what you did is no small thing, and on a topic that's, you know, sad and also beautiful. So it wasn't easy. And everyone thinks they can write a memoir. This I know.
This is a perfect segue to one of my my last question, which is about grief and the role of food in grief. And as you said, I have definitely written about that. It's a theme I find myself circling, you know, in some way or another here or there. But do you have a recollection, a memory of a pivotal first meal that you made after a loss? What things pulled to you in the kitchen in a time of grief?
I think I have been fortunate in that, you know, of course I have experienced loss. I've experienced loss of colleagues who transitioned way too young, way too early. But I don't have a memory of, you know, after that going and cooking and processing, through food. I have a memory of losing one of my favorite colleagues and friends. In fact, there is a book coming out about him. He was so remarkable. And what I remember is all of us gathering in the West Village and mourning and processing it. And the death was sudden and unexpected. And so just the how of it, the why of it, and just feeling like we were just going to only what I remember is feeling like we were going to only order fries. I think it was a pub or bar, and that's all they served. And it was just exactly the people I wanted to be with and exactly the thing I wanted to eat as you kind of process and mourn. And that, as I was thinking of this memory, I was like, you know, because usually afterwards you go and sit Shiva with somebody, or you go to a funeral. And what I love is how community will send food. Let's start a food train. You know, let's start, whether it's Whole Food gift card or who's going to make cakes or who's going to take care of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Those memories I have. But the moment that was most personal for me was gathering in a bar in the West Village and eating fries and, you know, having whiskey sours.
I can't think of a better way to put a button on this conversation, because that is, you know, there's a reason why they're called table fries.
It is.
Right? Because you can commune over potatoes, salt.
100%. Just dig in, have some more, get another round.
And talk some more, get another round. It's so good. Thank you very much, Dawn, for being with me here today on Lifted. This has been an absolute honor. I know listeners are going to love this conversation.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate talking to you and communing with you. It's been great.
Lifted is developed, written, and produced by me and my one-woman producing team, Celia Cates. It is edited by Jamie Moss. Thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for our next inspiring episode.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.